the high desert of northern New Mexico, this is Circle for Original Thinking. I am your host, Glenn Aparicio Perry. Welcome to Circle for Original Thinking, America's electronic talking circle for visionary thinkers, an open forum for fresh ideas and timeless wisdom applied to today's political and ecological challenges. Each episode, we bring together creative thinkers from a variety of different traditions. We ask the hard questions on the important issues of the day, political polarization, climate change, virulent viruses, and other symptoms of humanity being out of balance with the natural world. Our goal is to recreate a whole and sacred America and world, a new and improved version of E Pluribus Unum, from the many to the one. And this time, not leave anybody out. Join us as we embark on this quest. From September 23rd through September 30th of this year, there is a week of conferences celebrating 150 years of Sri Aurobindo, the pioneer of integral consciousness. The first conference is called Sustainability and Contemplative Civilization, the Integral Vision of Sri Aurobindo. And that conference runs from September 23rd through September 26th. The second conference begins immediately after and runs from September 27th through September 30th. The second conference is called the Emergence of Integral Consciousness. And that conference is also the annual conference of the Jean Gebser Society, of which I am currently the president. And it is done in conjunction with the East-West Psychology Department of California Institute of Integral Studies, the ACTS program, and also the Transformative Inquiry Department of CIIS. This podcast is recorded before the first conference begins, but it is a celebration of these two events. This podcast is also being aired as part of the regular East-West Psychology podcast, of which Jonathan Kay, a PhD student in East-West Psychology, and Stefan Julich, a core faculty member of East-West Psychology, are the hosts of that podcast. And we're being joined today by Debashish Banerjee, the head of the East-West Psychology program. So we're very blessed to have this conversation today. For more information on these conferences and to register, go to ciis.edu/events/150 years, or go to gebser.org. That's GEBSER.ORG. Now I want to introduce our guests. Debashish Banerjee, who has the distinction of being the keynote speaker in both conferences, is a Bengali scholar who specializes in integral yoga, Indian philosophy and psychology, art history and cultural theory. He's the Haridas Chaudhuri Professor of Indian Philosophies and Cultures and the Doshi Professor of Asian Art at the California Institute of Integral Studies. And of course, he also chairs the Department of East-West Psychology. We're also joined by Stefan Julich, who's core faculty in East-West Psychology at the California Institute of Integral Studies, specializing in Western esotericism and Jungian studies. Previously, Dr. Julich worked as an adjunct instructor in history and anthropology at City College of New York, and as a lecturer in Jungian studies at the University of Philosophical Research in Los Angeles, as well as an adjunct professor in East-West Psychology at CIIS. And we are also joined by Jonathan Kay, who's an internationally recognized cross-cultural jazz multi-instrumentalist on saxophone as Raj, Bansuri, Shakuhachi, who hails from Toronto, Canada. He lived in Calcutta, India for 10 years. He's an amazing musician who actually exemplifies the merging of East-West psychology in his music. And he's doing his PhD dissertation. He's starting out on that now in this musical hermeneutics journey. And it's Jonathan who's going to, we're going to turn it over to now, and we'll begin the program.
All right. Welcome, everybody. I'm very excited to be here with some of my very good friends and mentors as well and teachers to discuss an exciting month ahead at CIIS. I'm here with Stefan, the co-host of the East West Psychology podcast, Glenn Aparicio Perry, who's in our faculty in the department and also runs his own podcast called The Circle for Original Thinking, and the chair of the East West Psychology and the ACTS concentration, Debashish Banerjee. Welcome, everybody. We're here to discuss the two conferences that are happening at the end of September, in person and online. We have one called Sustainability and Contemplative Civilization, the Integral Vision of Sri Aurobindo, which is running from September 23rd to 26th. And the second conference is called The Emergence of Integral Consciousness, Jean Gebser, Sri Aurobindo, Carl Jung, and Teilhard de Chardin, which runs directly after that, September 27th to 30th. So why don't we discuss a little bit about how these two conferences came about and as sister conferences, and a little bit about the overarching ideas and views that will be shared in these conferences. And maybe Debashish, you could start by, situating this in the larger occasion of the 150th year of Sri Aurobindo. So please.
Yeah, thanks, Jonathan. So yes, actually this year is the 151st year of Sri Aurobindo's birth. And Sri Aurobindo was born in 1872. And the last year was really the 150th year of Sri Aurobindo. And a number of conferences and talks and events of various kinds were held, mostly in India, but some across the world. And I participated in one that was held at the École Normale Supérieure last year. And so since CIIS has an inspiration from Sri Aurobindo at its very founding, Haridas Chaudhary, who founded CIIS, was a disciple of Sri Aurobindo. I thought it's very appropriate for us to celebrate his 150th year by considering the relevance of his work. Sri Aurobindo, was a mystic, a yogi, but he was also a philosopher, a poet, a political thinker, a nationalist in India, an anti-colonial thinker. And to many people, he's a forgotten name. But that's exactly why I think the relevance of his thought today needs to be considered. So I thought of holding this one conference, actually, and particularly with view to considering his relevance, I thought about holding it around the notion of sustainability. So sustainability and contemplative civilization. And we can discuss this idea later, but that was the title, and I was subtitling it The Integral Vision of Sri Aurobindo. And then Glenn Aparicio Perry, who is an adjunct faculty and a friend, he is also the president of the International Gebser Society. And he had come along and he talked about the possibility of holding the annual International Gebser Conference at CIIS. And between the two of us, we thought it would be wonderful to hold these two conferences together so that there could be even a sharing of participants, of audience, and even of themes. Because the notion of integral, California Institute of Integral Studies, Sri Aurobindo's idea has been called integral yoga, integral thought, integral philosophy, etc. So as I was trying to look at a more holistic understanding of sustainability in relation to the vision of Sri Aurobindo, Glenn proposed a conference called The Emergence of Integral Consciousness, The Emergence of Integral Consciousness, which gives it a wider context, the whole idea of the integral. And I think, you know, we gave it an umbrella term, umbrella title. I called it 150 Years of Sri Aurobindo, the Pioneer of Integral Consciousness. So I think, you know, California Institute of Integral Studies, the term integral is in there, and not too many people have really given much thought to it. So this is a really appropriate time. There's a lot going on at CIIS, you know, and I think this is a very appropriate time to put our concentration on this idea, the idea of the integral, see some of its founding fathers, you know, the ideas that really can constitute the locus of this term. So that's how I see it. And I'll turn it over to Glenn to say a few words about your question, Jonathan.
Thank you, Debashish. You know, I first just want to say a prayer, really, for the ancestors and for everything that has happened to bring us to this moment in time. So, you know, a prayer for Sri Aurobindo, the mother, Haridas Jodhari, Dion Marks, Ralph Metzner, Angelus Arian, Paul Herman, so many people that came at CIIS that are now amongst the ancestors. I am so delighted and grateful that we can have these conferences back to back in 1 week and honor the 150th, or if it's, you know, just starting in the 151st year of since Sri Aurobindo's birth. Thank you. It's an honor to work with you, Debashish, and everyone on this call. Actually, this is really it's beautiful to be part of East-West Psychology. You know, I found out about Sri Aurobindo when I was a student at East-West Psychology in 1983. It's a long time ago now. And my first instructor was Dr. Reddy. And I was just mentioning to Debashish and the group that was gathered in India at Auroville, how it was like time traveling to return to India again and to sit at the knee of Debashish, who really feels Sri Aurobindo in his bones and in his heart so strongly. It was reminiscent of the way Dr. Reddy used to speak. It is so such a unusual synergy between Sri Aurobindo and Jean Gebser. They were both writing about integral consciousness at the same time, and they had not had any contact with each other. But Gebser did go to visit India and to the Sri Aurobindo ashram, and he spoke so lovingly about Sri Aurobindo and convincingly. He would say that, you know, it wasn't in the ever-present origin, but in a follow-up article called The Invisible Origin, he quotes Sri Aurobindo liberally. And when he quotes him, he says, these words are written from a consciousness that has experienced this. These are not abstract ideas, something to that effect. And so he really had the highest regard for Sri Aurobindo. And I don't know what Sri Aurobindo has said about Gebser, but I imagine he had regard for Gebser as well. And so it's a beautiful synergy. It's great to have this come together at the California Institute of Integral Studies. And I'll just say one other thing. When I did become president of the Gebser Society, which will be for a 2-year interim term, you know, I the first thing I suggested we do was to have a meeting of our board that was a retreat. We did it in Asilomar in California. And we dialogued about the vision and the mission of the Jean Gebser Society. And the vision that came out was really all about the emergence of integral consciousness. And so it made sense for us to plan our next conference with that theme. And you know, Sri Aurobindo was very clear that he had experienced integral or supramental consciousness back in 1926, you know, but it still needed to come and permeate the culture at large. And so that still is very much a work in progress. And but institutions like the California Institute of Integral Studies have done a lot to help usher in the age of integral consciousness. We're still not there yet, but this conference will do its part as well. So I'm just so grateful for it to come about, these conferences. Thank you so much.
I'm curious, because I don't know much about Gebser's work. The actual word integral, was it taken from Sri Aurobindo, or did he come to this on his own?
No, it wasn't taken from Sri Aurobindo because he didn't even know of him then. So he coined the words. I mean, he was writing in German. He was a Swiss. Switzerland was his adopted country, but he was writing in German. And the translation is that he coined the structures of consciousness as the archaic, the magical, the mythical, the mental, and the integral. They were using the same terms, at least integral. Yeah.
Yeah. Devashish, I was wondering if we could talk a little bit about the title that you gave the first conference, Sustainability and Contemplative Civilization. And especially maybe if you could talk about the ideas you've been developing as contemplative philosophy more recently, and how that really aligns and kind of brings out the importance of being a scholar practitioner. So that's one aspect that I thought you could speak a little bit about.
Yeah, thanks, Jonathan. So I also would like to invoke another institution that's a partner institution to this conference, particularly the first conference, and that's the Journal of Dharma Studies, of which I'm one of the co-editors in chief. So the Journal of Dharma Studies wants to dedicate a special issue. It's a peer-reviewed journal that's very well regarded, and it's run or owned by it's one of the major publishing houses. Essentially, the idea was that they're doing a special issue on contemplative studies, and this was Springer. Okay, so this is Journal of Dharma Studies is a Springer journal, and contemplative studies is a recent discipline, academic discipline, that we also field at CIIS. I teach it in East-West Psychology and for ACTS. And I think the notion of contemplative studies needs to be properly understood because there's many, just like the idea of integral. Like, integral can mean many things. So contemplation or contemplative can mean many things as well. For some people, contemplative is a quietistic kind of approach to reality. We enter, it's meditative. In other words, we meditate and we enter into a state of calm, and that can be called contemplative. For others, contemplative can have something to do with thought. In other words, we cogitate, we contemplate in that sense. We use our thought to contemplate. The Platonic dialogues or the Socratic dialogues of Plato could be called contemplative from that point of view. That's they're forcing reflection on experience to arrive at certain kinds of conclusions. But the way in which we are using contemplative studies now includes and exceeds these approaches. See, because a contemplative art, for example, is not necessarily restricted to something which is quietistic or meditative, but that is one of the foundations of it. It can be very active. It can be dynamic. It can be dance, for example. It can also be something like, I mean, if we think about the samurai in Zen culture, you know, even war can be contemplative from that point of view. I'm not making a case for it, but I'm saying that the idea of contemplative can include any activity that is founded in a state of inner consciousness, inner reflection and consciousness, a deeper state of unity, perhaps. So when we are talking about sustainability and contemplative civilization, the idea is that sustainability can be thought about in very secular terms that don't have anything to do with the spiritual. Sustainable society can be one that just keeps its attention on nature, on various kinds of entities, and gives value to them, inclusive value to them. And so sustainability in a wider sense is synonymous with integral in that sense, you know, and we can parse that term further, maybe later in our conversation. But sustainability, which really is based on an experience of wholeness, see, sustainability can be mental. But sustainability, which is based on an experience of wholeness that is more than mental, is what we are talking about when we think about it in terms of a contemplative civilization, a civilization which is based on deep states of unity. And that becomes like a complex state of unity is a state of integrality. See, so how can we think about sustainability in these experiential terms, in terms that include a realization of the whole? That would also bring it into contact with the notion of the integral in California Institute of Integral Studies. So that was how I thought about sustainability in terms of contemplative civilization of the future, and looked at the work of Sri Aurobindo as providing some illuminating guidance towards that. That would be the motive of that title.
I find this really fascinating, Debashish, your use of the word sustainable, because I think I'm not alone. The first thing that I think of, because of the way that the term is being used popularly in culture today, is ecology, in terms of ecology and creating a world of renewable resources where we use renewable resources and such. Yeah. But if you expand the use of the word ecology also, then it could be said that a sustainable civilization, a contemplative civilization, is also an ecosystem. So it's both interior and exterior. It's both material and spiritual and psychic.
Yes, indeed. I agree. We use terms like ecosophy, for example. That's more than ecology. And then we expand the idea to include all life. as and necessary to, this is why the notion of eco-psychology, right, which is not just an ecology of objects of nature, even if we consider nature as having consciousness, but it's a consciousness that is inclusive of all the types of beings having consciousness and not having consciousness too. Because in a way, it's a phenomenology of existence that we want to include in the notion of sustainability.
Len, I'm wondering if maybe you could comment on that in reference to Gebser's work.
Thank you. For me, I see the consciousness as the ground of all being. So I would definitely not only equate consciousness to nature, I would say that's where it comes from. You know, so when I think about the term eco-psychology, I literally think about our thoughts as emerging from nature. And I've had some unusual experiences in my life that have validated that kind of concept. You know, I was once at a sacred grounds of the Cañoncito Band of Navajo at a gathering, and I was selected to be the firekeeper, and this is many years ago, and I did not understand the concept, so I was learning very much so. And I kept the fire, at the end of the evening, when people turned in, I went back to my tent and went to sleep, not assuming that somebody else would take care of the fire. And then I soon awoke, and I heard Grandfather Leon Secatero's voice as clear as day, speaking very gently, and he had the softest, most mellifluous voice, and he spoke in my ear, and he said, "Glenn, get up and tend the fire." So I did. I got up, I tended the fire and brought it back to a roaring blaze. But he wasn't there, you know, it was just his voice. So in the next day, I found out that he wasn't even at the site at all. He had got a psychic message that some people were lost, not a cell phone call, because there's no cell phones up there. And he went to retrieve these people somehow, and he did. And so we were out on a hike, and I took the opportunity to ask him about how did that happen. I wanted to know how he knew that I needed to tend the fire. Well, he didn't answer me. Like a lot of Native elders, he just pointed to what we were looking at and refocused my attention. And it was only later that his son, who's trained in the medicine ways as well, Orlando Secatero, suggested to me that the very message came from the fire itself, using Leon's voice to get my attention. And I thought, wow, yes, that actually makes some sense. Because one way or the other, we receive inspiration and from nature. And we say the word inspiration, which is literally breath, you know, and so we are, yeah, I really feel that strongly in my bones that all of nature is conscious. Now, when you use the word sustainable, I confess that normally, just like Stefan said, I normally associate it with ecology, and sometimes I associate it with sustaining the current lifestyle. And I'm really grateful to hear Debashish's explanation, because he's grounding it in a whole other way, bringing together the terms sustainability and contemplative. So he's really bringing together the outer and the inner in a beautiful way, and a way that I don't think many people have looked at. So it's a great opportunity to examine this at the conference.
So I wanted to also state, I mean, apropos of that, thank you, Glenn, for that beautiful story about tending the fire. It reminds me of the Upanishads, where sometimes, you know, things like the fire, there's an entire story where there's an aspirant student of a guru who's sent out into the wilderness with a herd of cows to learn something, you know, but he's not even told what he's there to learn. And he finds four teachers, one of which is the fire that he was tending, actually. So it's very interesting how, you know, the guru, the great teacher, comes to us through all these levels, you know, and it's really part of this larger notion of sustainability that we are talking about, that to listen to the voice of the one that comes to us from all these levels. But I wanted to also say that in Sri Aurobindo himself, he died in 1950, and he did not live to see the kind of extreme effects, malefic effects, of modern technology, you know, in devastating the world. And also, you know, I mean, the various layers of this particular devastation, for example, the desecration of the earth and of nature. But, you know, the mother who lived till 1973, saw some of that and foresaw a lot of that. And that's why she started the experiment of Auroville, where we recently went, Glenn and Jonathan, which actually had that foresight. That's really a place for a contemplative civilization, a society, a contemplative society that addresses, I'd say, sustainability at all these levels. The level of the geological, the level of the zoological, the biological, and also the level of the, we could call it the psychological. So, you know, there's the layer of culture, nature and culture together make up the domain of the sustainable. And I think that's what the idea of looking at the possibilities, what are the, what is the infrastructure, the inner and outer infrastructure for a sustainable contemplative society of the future?
I just like to say one thing that Sri Aurobindo did live long enough to see the atomic bomb exploded. So that's a huge shift in the world. And it kind of is a metaphor for this literally atomic consciousness that kind of tears things apart. So we tore apart something that maybe should never have been separated, and caused the most devastating bomb and bombs. And of course, since then, we've created even worse bombs that have not been used on human beings yet, and hopefully never will be. But so he did live for long enough for that, but he didn't see some of the ecological degradation that's been done with soil, with water. I wasn't born till 1955, but in my lifetime, I have seen the degradation of water to an extreme degree. I mean, I was visiting Spain when I was a teenager and stopping at all the agua fresca, the place to drink fresh water, and very rarely is this done anymore. It's very sad.
Yeah, so part of what we're speaking about in terms of addressing the idea of civilization, I mean, another way to speak is building culture, building new cultures And, you know, part of that is being in a critical relationship to the culture that one is from. And Debashish, in the conference overview, you bring up this idea that we're kind of in an episteme that is based on the ontology of ownership. Capital is the master signifier. And so this critical turn away from some of the structures, the larger kind of, you know, superstructures that we can analyze in different ways through different thinkers and their models as well. But can we talk a little bit more about this idea of how, like, an integral culture, building an integral culture? And so the collection of thinkers, the milieu of thinkers that we're drawing from, have different ways of talking about accessing or building or remembering different structures of consciousness. And one of the interesting ones to me, and something I've been experimenting with and is important to me, is this shift from more of the rational, which spatializes time, to thinking more along the lines of a temporal consciousness. And music in my life would be a practice in which I experiment in that way. But I was just wondering if we could all kind of just discuss a little bit more about ways in which we're thinking about this, building this new culture and the types of the structure of consciousness that we need to either be in critical relationship to exceed or to overcome, and new kind of inventive or novel ways to become differently, so as to really form new ideas of the self, to question the self, to remake the self, and then also to extend that into to community and collectivity.
Yeah, Jonathan, if I may, I mean, because you brought up the notion of integral, and then you also brought up some very stimulating kind of concepts, the concept of the ontology of ownership, and also this notion of a switch from kind of spatialized, sort of ontology to a temporal ontology. And so when we're talking about ontology of ownership, by ontology of ownership is meant the fact that we have a diversified culture, and particularly at the level of the human, we have individuals, and the entire modern period is really about individualism. And the fact that individuals are defined by their mental identities, and how even at the level of the individual, not even at the level of ideas, but at the level of the individual is an idea of the self. And that idea of the self is pitted against all other selves. You know, that's the ontology of ownership, that I am the center of the universe, and I can extend my sense of I to those that I can own. See, so it becomes really a culture of competition and of displacement of others. You know, so this is what we've been taught to assume as the very foundation of our existence. That's the modern world. And when we are talking about integral in that sense, and I would also first try to address what you said about space and time. So you see the fact that there is a kind of a diversification of numbers, of entities, individuals that are all separated from each other in terms of our sensory experience of things. But, you know, we can also see as human beings that there is the notion of an ecosystem in nature, that there are, you know, hidden assumed unities that conserve themselves. And we've broken from that, you see. So we've broken away as individuals that obey this ontology of ownership from the secret unities of nature. But at the same time, we've come to a point where we are asking the question about, is there a perspectival meeting, vanishing meeting point? I'm talking a little bit in Gebserian terms now, because he's the one who raises the whole issue of the aperspectival. Is there a vanishing point where all perspectives are present on a single plane. And that really is a seeking, an aspiration. When we're talking about spatialized and temporalized ontologies, you see, again, we look at the world, we experience it spatially through relations that are situated in space between different entities that take themselves as separate. But if we actually intuit the fact that this is all become, it's all, everything is a bit, each one of us is a becoming. We are taking ourselves at a certain point in time to be who we are, but we are changing even as we speak. And if we really go deep into ourselves, we find the root of something that unites us, because we've diversified from a single consciousness that is changing. You see, that's the heterogeneity of becoming, of the one. There's one being that is becoming. And so when we are talking integral, we're actually trying to see whether we can come to that sense or intuition of the one that is becoming, even as it has become the many. See, it's present in all of us and is becoming through us, but it is still the one in its multiplicity. And can we contact that? That becomes one of the lines of contemporary philosophy that is trying to approach, I would say, what is called the integral, which is the coexistence. This is the perspectival vanishing point, the aperspectival, where there's the coexistence of the one and the radically infinite.
If I may jump in, thank you. Thank you for that. You know, thank you, Jonathan, for bringing up a shift from spatialized to temporal. I think that shift has definitely been made in the West. I often say that the West has replaced place with time. So that's and I think we can trace this to the advent of linear perspective in art. You know, and so once you have the advent of linear perspective in art, we still have these expressions in our common language. Like we say something's going to happen in the near future, something's going to happen in the distant future. And we've shifted the way that we perceive the world. It happened during Da Vinci's lifetime. I mean, Da Vinci, when he was a young person, it was understood that the natures emanated energies and the eye was receptive. But, you know, after linear perspective comes in, like Debashish is talking about, we start to accredit everything to the human eye. So the human eye becomes at the center. And this kind of brings about the egoic way of looking at the world, and also the idea that humans are animate and everything else isn't. You know, so for me, you know, and I, some of the richest nourishment I've ever received in the world has been from Native Americans. And when I convened dialogues that brought together Western scholars with Native scholars, the very first one we had for the Seed Institute in 1999, the moderator was Leroy Little Bear, and he asked the question, is it possible to have an original thought? And this most interesting thing happened when he asked that question, because, and this goes right to your question, Jonathan, because the indigenous people took that question as an invitation to connect to origin as a place. But the Western people struggled to, and there were some exceptions. Lee Nichol, who was David Bohm's editor, took a little bit different approach. In general, the Western people tried to think of something that was brand new, that had never been said before or done before. And that's a really hard thing to try to think about, and they really struggled with it. But it brings us to, you know, back to Gebser. He very succinctly said that what has happened in the West is that we've mistaken distance from the origin and called it progress. So we've mistaken distance from the origin and called it progress. So that gets really to the heart of this difference in looking at origin as a place or origin as the beginning of time. I mean, when you, I love Brian Swim's work, you know, at PCC and in the California Institute of Integral Studies, because he's a great storyteller, you know. So, but he tells the story of the origin of the cosmos as some event that happened in time. It doesn't really matter what place it was at. But if you ask an indigenous person about their origin stories, they always go to a place. Like if you ask the Hopi, they'll go to the confluence of the Little Colorado and the Big Colorado rivers, and that's where they see the, that's where they say the Sipapu, the opening, is where they came from the lower world up into this world. So it is a big shift. But I just want to say one more thing. You know, indigenous people don't necessarily have a limited view. That's that is something that is misunderstood, I feel. You know, if this were a visual podcast, I would show you the cover of a book by Pablita Velarde. It's called Old Father Storyteller. And in that image, and she lived in New Mexico till she was 95, and she actually died in a car accident. She might still be around. I mean, she was pretty vital. And she draws an image where the storyteller is very large. And then there's also a very large eagle above him. And then there's the Milky Way, which is considered the trail of the ancestors. So she has pictures of the ancestors up there. And all of that is totally out of perspective in the way that we would think of linear perspective in art. But then she draws the village behind it in perfect linear perspective. So she is able to use both. She's able to use both the immersive view that makes the storyteller so much more important, larger than life. And she also is able to see things in linear perspective. So it could be, and to me, it seems like there's a lot of similarity even between Sri Aurobindo, Gebser, people who are opening to a really wider consciousness, and some of the consciousness that's still retained in Native American thinking.
Vishesh, I want to just jump in and actually ask maybe for your help in clarifying this. I'm, you know, thinking of, I was thinking of a couple of things, but one of the images that was coming to me was something that the story of Iron John that I learned from Robert Bly many, many years ago, back in the 1980s, attending workshops and talks. And there's an image, there's a kind of a piece from that story where a child whose golden ball has gone into the cage of the wild man releases the wild man to get the golden ball back, maybe representative of the self. And then the wild man carries the child into a forest and plunks him down by a pond. And he says, I have to go get our dinner, but you sit here and make sure that nothing falls into this pond. And of course, you know, a leaf falls in the pond and the child can't stop it. And then the wild man says to him, you know, if this happens again, you're going to have to go. And then the next day, the child becomes fascinated with the pond and is gazing at it, and a piece of his hair kind of blows from his head and falls in the pond before he can catch it. And the wild man comes back and he says, you know, you're going to have to leave if, you know, I give you one more chance. And the next day the boy is gazing at his own image in the pond and all his hair just kind of falls like this into the water. And before he can get it back, it's completely soaked and it turns gold. And when the wild man comes back, he says to him, now it's time for you to leave. So, and when I listened to this story, I thought, well, he's being punished, but something miraculous has happened. And Bly pointed out that this could take a year, it could take 10 years, it could take a lifetime for this process to happen. So there's this image, which is the place, the pond, and then there is this temporal aspect to it, which is, I would say, in some ways, a perspectival, because you don't know where, when that process will be complete. The process could be, it's an individual process, but could, it could also be a collective process. So what this brings to mind for me is, if I can sneak in Jung, which is the power of the story, the power of the mythic retelling, or the mythic telling of this, of a story that can be told philosophically, it can be told more abstractly. And this is, Debashish, where I wanted to ask you this question, is that my understanding is that Sri Aurobindo in some ways left off writing more philosophical treatises to really focus on savitri in a way because of the power of the image that it may have had a greater ability to move the person that's encountering it than maybe a philosophical discourse.
Yes, Steph. I think that makes a lot of sense. I think even as far as philosophy goes, he has adulated poetic philosophy, the philosophy of the Upanishads, for example, that is told through parables, told through paradoxes. And essentially, yes, the kind of story that is not linear in that sense that, you know, that Glenn was talking about, where you can actually say two things at the same time. Even talking about place, you have the notion, for example, there are several sites in the Mount Kailash is one of them. You know, it's the holiest mountain of the Hindus. It's the holiest mountain of the Tibetans, so it's got a number of cultures that take it to be the center of the universe. And at the same time, it doesn't become exclusive. It isn't that because it's my holiest mountain, it's the center of my unit, it can't be yours. You see, that's one aspect of this plurality that belongs to that kind of a consciousness that accepts the origin to be one and infinite at the same time. You see, and on the other hand, you have places, you know, the Ganga, for example, right? The Ganga can be a river that starts somewhere in the Himalayas, at an origin that's hidden, right? It comes out of the mountain. But the Ganga is also present in your home, in a little pot of Ganga water. You see, so it pluralizes. It's as holy as that river out there. You see, so in a way, it takes its power from that place, you know, that origin place, but it really is everywhere. It's the center without a circumference in that sense, without a center and a circumference. It's the circle without a center and a circumference. So, thinking about these things, both in terms of, what makes them historically unique and what pluralizes them to become everything. So to say, this is the image that Glenn was talking about in the telling, takes us into that aperspectival, into the sense of people like Spinoza would call univocity, the one that speaks in an infinite tongues.
Mm. Beautiful. Beautiful. I wonder if I could ask this group of wonderful people a question. How can we, what can we do to help usher in this age of the integral? We could also call it the age of the aperspectival or the atemporal, but this, how can we help usher in this age where we can, like Debashish is saying, access the origin, and have that power with us at all times? How can we help usher that into the society at large?
I'd like to quickly just respond by saying, I think Debashish, you brought this up earlier, but to have that as a goal, I think is the first thing that comes to mind. And it's something that I feel that is the most powerful idea or that has become a goal of mine. And I didn't grow up with that. I don't feel in the way that I understand it now. I traveled a lot. I lived in India and other places, and I experienced a lot of things in the world. But I think that having that as a goal and sustaining that from moment to moment has been the way that I feel is the only way that I can be equal to that goal. And not to spend time thinking that I'm doing that and then spend other time where I'm completely unconscious and disregarding the consequences of my actions in relation to that goal. So like really central, that's the kind of the Bindu point of the kind of the mandala of becoming in a way for me. So maybe I just offer that into the circle.
Well, idea that I was hoping and in the concept note of sustainability and contemplative civilization that I'm trying to draw attention to are experiments of this kind in communities, intentional communities that can hold this collectively as a goal, you see. So that's what the mother wanted to do with Auroville, for example, that here are people with completely different backgrounds, social, cultural, assumptions about reality can come together and actually aspire not to create something that, you know, sort of becomes uniform, that everybody agrees about, but something that they can intuit as the unity within the diversity. You see that they can actually agree that there is an earth that they share. They can agree that there is a spirit that they share, and that the values, the ideas that come from it, however they want to translate it into their lives, belongs to all of them. I think that takes us back again into the notion of the integral. And I think individually, and in our practices as collectives, it's a praxis in that sense, that it's a kind of a conscious practice, a practice that has a goal of becoming to it.
Stefan?
I mean, there's a way in which in our program, and I think that Debashish has really brought this into the program and into this kind of discourse that the students and the faculty in the program are having, a way of modeling and encouraging and catalyzing maybe a kind of a radical plurality. And there's a way in which I'm hearing more and more students in the program speak to one another, and the kind of a holding or a way in which there's much more of a space in the way that they're talking for this view or for this way of being or becoming. But interesting to me is that as I go out into the world, and I spent the summer among with my partner's family in India, and just a regular Indian household. Well, maybe not just a regular Indian household, because I had no idea the first time that I went there that I would find a huge portrait of the mother on the wall. And then I spent 10 days in Florida with my own family, and I don't expect. Sometimes I feel like I'm learning a language that is makes it difficult for me to communicate with people who aren't initiated into that language. And yet, if I listen really carefully, it seems that there is definitely something afoot. There's definitely some change that's taking place. I don't know how long it will take. It seems like we don't have a lot of time. It needs to happen quickly. But it feels to me as if the predictions that the mother made and that Sri Aurobindo made are actually coming to pass. I'm saying that I when I say that, I get a little bit nervous because then I feel like I'm giving a testimonial to, you know, a religious belief. But it's more than that. It's intuitive, but it's also embodied. It's an embodied experience of a breaking of the frame. And I don't think it's just me. I think it's maybe the complexity of the society as our society complexifies and as things seem to speed up. I don't know if what I'm saying is if it's an accurate observation, but that's the way that it feels to me.
Thank you for sharing that story, because it reminded me of what you said when you first came to CIIS. You said you came in and you saw the photo of the mother, right? And did you not tell me this before? Yeah. And so now you've gone into your beloved wife's parents' home and you saw the photo again. This is not a coincidence. There's something, you know, like you said, there's something afoot. There's something that is happening for you and for the whole culture. I just see unity and diversity as being at the very core of East-West psychology, and really at the very core of our emergence as a and our survival as a species, certainly. Wow. I mean, to me, it's like unity and diversity is like every person, like every student is their own ray of the sun, but they are also a unity. They all shine. They can all be individuals, but they're also individual in the original sense of the word, which is, you know, indivisible. They're connected as one whole. So it's very, very beautiful. Very, very beautiful. And I will say one thing about, you were saying that Gebser and, I'm sorry, that Aurobindo and the mother were seeing this emergence, but also Gebser was seeing this. And one thing I get from, and by the way, the second conference will also include Carl Jung and Teilhard de Chardin. So there's these, it's a Gebser conference, but it's Gebser, Aurobindo, Jung, Teilhard de Chardin, and it's also open for people to bring in other things. Gebser was very strong, I would say, and correct me if I'm wrong, Debashish or Stefan or Jonathan, but it seems like even more so than Aurobindo, he emphasized the what was coming in terms of the rational falling apart, to coming into the deficient rational. You know, the original meaning of rational, as David Bohm spoke about, you know, had to do with ratio or proportionality between things. For the ancient Greeks, it was divine proportion. It was very beautiful. It was the highest form of thought ever to emerge. But that's what Gebser would call the efficient rational. But now it doesn't take any genius to look around and see that we are really in the deficient rational, where people can't agree on a common set of facts, and our politics is really dissonant and extremely polarized. But all of this may be necessary in order to give fertile soil for integral consciousness to emerge. So it's hard sometimes, but I want to focus my attention on giving water to the seeds I want to see grow in the world, and also giving the light, the air, and the soil. Because yeah, it's coming. It's here. It's right before our eyes. The beauty is unfolding like the lotus. But at the same time, we see all this other stuff that's falling, you know, that's very dissonant. So we have to let that happen so that the beauty can emerge. Does that make sense?
Yeah, Glenn, I completely agree with you. And actually, so Sri Aurobindo talks about the same. He talks about the end of the curve of reason. You know, he has a chapter called The End of the Curve of Reason in the Human Cycle. And that is supposed to lead to the subjective age and the spiritual age. Or the, we could think of it as the integral age. But I see so clearly as well that it's not a given. You know, it's a possibility. And maybe if there is a grace, and that's where things like, you know, what Stefan was saying comes in, maybe there's something beyond our understanding that is also present, but it's present along with a huge destruction that's going on in our times. And we have to be very conscious of that and conscious of the choices we make, you know, for the vision. That's where the goal of becoming comes in. Unless one has a clear goal of exceeding that, that's where the teachings of these people become so important. You know, to have that vision that people like Gebser or Teilhard de Chardin, with his notion of the new sphere, you know, Jung in talking about individuation as an embodiment of the archetypes, or Sri Aurobindo talking about a plane of consciousness that is beyond the mind and not infrarational, but suprarational. You know, that I think a goal that takes us beyond ourselves is possible to the human. And I think that it's difficult, but it's possible. And that's where the whole crux comes in, because it's so difficult for the human to accept that we can, you know, actually live beyond the frontiers of the rational.
I want to say one thing to build on that, almost on behalf of you, Jonathan, because you probably would never toot your own horn, literally. But at the second conference, and maybe at the first, I don't know, everything that you planned, but we're asking Jonathan to he's going to give one presentation that is that does talk about integral music, but he'll also play some, and he'll be playing a concert. And then during breaks, he and possibly a native flute player also will play some music at the breaks, because, you know, we need to break up intellect to experience something that is beyond. And Jonathan, if I may toot your horn, I mean, you're just an amazing pioneer in creating East-West music. So thank you so much for that.
Thanks, Glenn. Yeah. But in the first conference, there will be an Indian classical music recital by the Mishra brothers as well. And so I think, you know, this, I'm really happy that you brought that up, because it was really on my mind to also bring out to the listeners that this is a very innovative and activist, and in some senses revolutionary approach, not only to academics and thinking, but to creating culture. And I think that this week at CIS is really going to be quite important for me and this community. But is there any last words that we should the two of you as a conference organizers want to share, because this will be listened to by people before the conferences, hopefully. Is an invitation to attend online or in person if you're in the Bay Area, and also this podcast will be available after the conferences as well, with all of the rich concepts and ideas that we've talked about as well. But maybe we'll leave it to the two of you, Debashish and Glenn, to speak to the conferences more specifically.
Well, I think I invite, just like you did, Jonathan, invite all the listeners to attend. There'll be a very rich palette of different offerings. You know, we're going to look at these ideas from various directions, and have a chance to internalize them and possibly live them in our lives. So welcome to the conference, Glenn.
Yeah, and we'll also be, we also want to invite everybody to attend. I think that we have some incredible speakers. There are people in the Gaebser Society, like Dave Zuckerman, John Dotson, Mike Purdy, who go way back to the original formation of the Gaebser Society, and Algis Mikunis, who did the translation of The Ever-Present Origin. He's not going to be, I don't think, at this conference, but he was at the last conference. We also have people who are very drawn to Sri Aurobindo, and they feel him in their soul, like John Dotson. I mean, he came in contact with Sri Aurobindo and Gaebser in the same breath, you know, when he was 19 years old, so many, many, many years ago. So it's going to be special. We will also include dialogue. I haven't scheduled everything out, but at some point we will have a dialogue circle. The circle itself, to me, is a very powerful symbol of the integral. You know, and Debashish was mentioning it earlier. The circle is and the listening circles are about listening for the purpose of understanding. They're not about reading replies. So it's not a kind of conference where people will be trying to one up somebody else. And to be quite frank, the one thing I like about the Gaebser Society is that the people that seem to be drawn to it are brilliant, but they're not arrogant. They don't sit there and argue. They sit there and listen and learn from each other. And that's really a beautiful thing. And that's what we seek to do in dialogue, too. And I'm sure that's going to be the same in the first conference, too, because that's always the whenever you three are around, I feel the same. You know, you're all about being inclusive. You're actually very loving people. So I think that will come through, I'm sure, in the first conference as well.
Thanks, Glenn. Thanks, Debashish, for your spending time with us today. And thanks, Stefan, as well, for being here and for such a rich conversation. We'll definitely look out for videos and also publication from at least the first conference, like Debashish had mentioned, in the Journal of Dharma Studies. But we'll definitely have videos up and whatnot. So if you're listening to this after the conference itself, then links will be in the episode description below for you to do that. And if you're listening to this before the conference, then registration links will be in the program description, so you can get right to register, and we'll hopefully see you there.
Excellent. And we also plan to have a publication after the conference. So it's really great. Thank you. Thank you so much, everyone. This program is made possible in part by SelectBooks, Waterside Publications, BizGenics, and the Ecology Prime Media Channel. Executive producer Kenichi Sugihara. Native flute music by Orlando Secatero from the Pathways CD. Liberty song by artist Ron Crowder, written by Ron Crowder, Jim Casey, and Danny Casey. Post-production editing by Kenichi Sugihara. The Circle for Original Thinking is a grassroots think tank whose mission is to seek out the deep origins of contemporary thought in order to remember and restore heart-centered wisdom for humanity and all our relations on Earth. Follow this podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Listen Notes, or wherever podcasts are heard. For more information, go to originalthinking.us or originalpolitics.us. And you can also find and purchase my books, Original Thinking and Original Politics, there. Thank you for listening, and until next week, many blessings of good health and well-being to you. For more information on these conferences and to register, go to cis.edu/events/150 years, or go to gebser.org. That's GEBSER.org. Thank you. Hope to see you online or in person.